Live from New York City, it's The Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, broadcasting and video streaming live from our studios in New York City, and I'd like to welcome you to this program. You can also watch today's program in real time by going to Progressive Radio Network Facebook. And I want to thank the thousands of people who did that yesterday. And also, you can download the program if you can't watch it live. And from the archives, some YouTube, Gary Null YouTube, and you can watch it, or you can just listen to it. Today, we have the latest on health and healing. And I'm going to talk a little bit about drinking and when drinking is too much, and what the latest studies show. And also, I'm going to talk about, for those who believe that vaccines have been proven safe and effective, new material has just come out showing simply not true. If they say that the vaccines are safe, what's their proof? They didn't do the studies. That's according to them. Also today, my guest in the second part of our program will be Professor Michael Hudson, in my opinion, one of the brightest economists in the world. In fact, he travels all over the world and counsels other governments. Now, here's the question. We've been told that we need tariffs in order to protect American workers. Well, it works just the opposite. How the President of the United States and all the advisors around him could accept, if they do, that we should be having these high tariffs in the United States is simply wrong. Michael will explain this in detail. In fact, I will ask Michael, is it not true that Russia, that has had severe economic sanctions, is stronger now because they found other ways of creating products that otherwise they would have had to have imported and did? Now they make or grow these things themselves. And how does that work against us, not for us? How does that work for the countries that have sanctions and have figured out how to beat the sanctions to their betterment? We're going to deal with all this. Plus, I have some questions about the economy I'm going to be asking him. Also today, I want to get the audience, you, to call in and share your points of view on the nanny state. And I'm going to be playing you two clips, video clips you'll watch, about how, one, the government is mining data on our children in order to try to create ways of teaching them how to conform, to agree to consensus, to realizing if they think in the wrong way, they'll be punished. In the right way, they'll be rewarded. Doing it very quietly. But one mother who found out her child was asked some very bizarre questions went further, took her 4 years of diligent work, got the information, and will present it. Also, I remember back in the 1970s, there was a couple that contacted me up in Albany. They did not want their child, based upon the research they had done, to receive standard chemotherapy for the cancer. It was not leukemia that the child had. They believed, based upon the scientific literature, that the child would be better served using other non-invasive therapies. They actually had doctors, board-certified physicians, working with them. The state came in and took their child away from them and forcibly gave the child massive amounts of chemotherapy, nearly killed the child. And so they intervened in court, got permission to treat the child, and I got them into a clinic in the Bahamas, Dr. Burton. I went down and visited the child. Never will forget when I came up, he was sitting on a swing outside the clinic, and I said, it's boring here, isn't it? He's, yeah, nothing to do. I said, well, let's, you know, the mother was there. I said, let's go downtown, see how the local people spend their afternoons. And it was just one of those wonderful things that he had recovered. He was actually on his way to being cured. The media never covered that. and the media would not have covered the fact that he would have died. That is the norm today. The government takes your children for a lot of reasons. Illegitimate reasons. That's a part of the nanny state. And we're going to show you a couple that have had their child taken away now and are fighting. And then that's going to lead into, how did we get here? And there's one person, he's very controversial. You could agree or disagree. There are things I agree, things I disagree with what he says, but he is smart. I watched him in a debate at Oxford, in one of the Oxford University debates, and you really should download these. These are interesting debates. They only give you a short period of time, like 13 minutes, to make your arguments for and against, and then the people vote. And this is one of the oldest debating groups in the world, and you'll see him in action. And then I want you to respond. I'll share my thoughts after you share yours. So we have this to share today. Let's get started. This is the latest study, and it's from Boston University School of Medicine. It says almost half of U.S. adults who drink too much and then continue to do so. Quote, a new study led by Boston University School of Public Health, researchers have found that about 40% of adults in the United States who drink alcohol do so in amounts that risk health consequences and identifies a range of factors associated with starting or stopping drinking too much. And this was published in the Journal of Substance Use. My thoughts on this. All alcohol is bad. There is no such thing as good alcohol. But you're going to say, hold on, Gary, that's not the case, because for decades we were encouraged to drink 2 glasses of alcohol a day to help our heart. What proof? I wrote a book on alcohol. I've written papers on it. I actually went to France to see where it all started. It was called the French Paradox, which meant that in France, they do not have a low-fat diet. They have a very high-fat diet. They eat a lot of animal proteins, a lot of dairy, cheeses. And yet, their blood lipid levels are not the same as Americans, and they do not suffer the same levels of heart attack, stroke, high blood pressure. So they came away saying that it was the alcohol. They were incorrect. When I went there, and I went into the country and I visited dozens upon dozens of people's homes, because one of my friends has a home in France and took me up and down the villages. We'd go into villages and homes. The people almost always finish a meal with fruit. They do have their own homemade, organic, sulfate-free, low alcohol, like 2% alcohol, and that's what they consume. So when you look at the alcohol they're consuming from organic grapes, you're getting resveratrol. And this resveratrol, which is very powerful in polyphenols, helps thin the blood. It helps deocclude the arteries. It helps strengthen the heart. It is one of our principal 5 principal anti-aging nutrients. It's good for the brain. It's good for the heart. It's good for the eyes. And yet, we misinterpreted the alcohol, thinking it's alcohol. And I only knew this, how bad the interpretation was, when I was counseling a lawyer one afternoon, and he's saying, Gary, I don't know why I have this heart condition, because I'm doing everything right. I listen to your radio show, and I'm following the diet. And I said, there has to be something. When we were going over, he says, I just went to my cardiologist, and my cholesterol is high, my triglycerides are high, my LDLs are very high, my liver's not functioning right, my kidney's not functioning right, and I'm suffering from myopathy, cardiomyopathy. And my cardiologist he doesn't know what to do. And then he said something. He said, and I'm doing exactly what he told me. I said, what did he tell you? Have 2 drinks of alcohol a day. And what kind of alcohol do you drink? I drink scotch twice a day, a glass. A glass of scotch twice a day, 80% alcohol. So I showed him then and there the studies that I had on one glass of alcohol will destroy immediately a million brain cells, a million kidney cells, a million liver cells, erodes the stomach lining, causes massive inflammation in your intestines that can lead to colorectal cancer or stomach cancer, destroys the esophageal lining, allowing for esophageal cancer, and also destroys the eyes, creating macular degeneration, cataracts, and glaucoma because of oxidative stress. That is what one glass of alcohol does a day. The trouble is they misinterpreted the original research of what the French paradox really meant. That's where a lack of scholarship, a lack of real research is dangerous. So here's the takeaway message. Boston University did a good job in informing people that half of Americans drink too much. Two drinks is considered too much. In fact, in England, they're saying that you're binge drinking if you drink 2 pints of a weak alcohol. 2 pints. Now, if you've ever been to Ireland, 2 pints doesn't even get you started. And if you go to London, all these pubs, and they drink the warm beer. How anybody could drink warm beer is beyond me, but they like warm beer. And that is considered too much, binge. You go to a college campus, and you're seeing on some college campuses, they'll drink, binge drinking is 20 drinks until they literally vomit and pass out and die and create irreversible damage to their kidneys, their heart, and their brain. So they may be 21 chronologically, they're 60 biologically. And that's why they're dying at young ages. So if they took the research deeper, they would say that if you're going to drink any alcohol, have an organic, sulfate-free, red, not white, wine, generally one that has low alcohol. It's the alcohol that hurts. Now, you can say, well, you're drinking the low alcohol, you're getting resveratrol, but the wine that they're drinking in Italy, in Spain, in France, is a different wine than what you're getting generally in the United States, just like olive oil. I went into a home in Italy and this wonderful kitchen. I mean, if you were creating a movie set to say, what would be the most beautiful kitchen you could make? It would be giant glass kegs with fermented foods, dried olives, olives that are being cured, then mushrooms hanging and garlics and shallots hanging, and all this around you, surrounded by different foods and spices, 100 spices. And that's actual homes I've been in. One home was 800 years old, and it had that old smell. And in any case, they had at least 30 different types of olive oil, all of which was grown in their local community, and they share, which is good. They have like cooperatives. One person makes all the homemade brick oven breads, which are very chewy, very thick. They have a lot of that lignocellulose. They do stone grinding. I've actually seen the stone grinding. We don't do stone grinding. We refine the whole, everything is good. The endosperm, the nutrients, the vitamin B complex, the fibers, all removed. You're left with a white, refined, worthless carbohydrate in our pastas and our breads and our food. Not so in many places in France and Italy and Portugal. In any case, so they said, let's, before lunch, test some olives and olive oil. Okay, so I was trying different olives that I'd never tasted before, and then the olive oils. And what I noticed was they were all very dark. I stuck the little, they give you a little piece of this homemade bread. You stick the bread in, and you try it. And it was so strong, I had a hard time eating it. I said, this is a little on the strong side. Oh, no, we got real strong. And I looked at this one olive oil, and it looked like motor oil. kind of tastes like motor oil. It's a developed taste. But this is the healthiest oil. This is what the real Italians eat. And so it would, first, because the beauty of the Italian and the French culture, may put it on your bucket list to get there, because they're wonderful human beings. Secondly, because if you get out of the cities, get out of the suburbs and go to the country, it's where you'll get original, traditional meals served the right way with foods that they grow themselves, that our neighbors grow, they share, and especially the olive oils. What we get here is frequently fake oil, canola oil or soy oil that's has a tiny pinch of any olive oil. Organized crime does a lot of that. So always check your brand and get a certification. Call the company and say, can you email me a certification that this oil has been checked to make sure it's not fraudulent olive oil? And like Bragg's is a legitimate oil. It would be good. Spectrum is a legitimate oil. But don't take it for granted, because you could be deceived. Stay away from light oils. Go for the dark oils. Anyhow, then you start seeing why they live such long lives, why they don't suffer from heart disease as we do, because they're living close to the grid. They're eating clean food, healthy food, and natural. But if you wanted to drink wine to get the resveratrol, you're not getting a lot of resveratrol, maybe 5 milligrams. What do you really want in order to help yourself? About 200 milligrams. So if I wanted a lot of resveratrol from something natural, I'd drink a glass of organic Concord grape juice. Delicious. I could eat the grapes, but remember, you have to eat an awful lot of grapes of what's already been pressed into that grape juice. If I wanted even more, I would get the grape concentrate. I have about 30 different concentrates in my kitchen. I did this a long time ago, and I don't know where the footage is. It's probably in our archives. And one of my projects starting in the fall, because in the fall I'm going to go back home, and I'm building a state-of-the-art television studio where all my lectures, I have over 100 lectures I've filmed over my career, I've never shown. And even major documentaries. I have 5 documentaries I've never shown. So I'm going to start hiring someone that's just going to be full-time as a film archivist. I have over 1,000 films. I'm going to have them archive it, and I'm going to stream every day so you could see all the people I filmed around the world, because I might film someone for an hour and use a minute in a documentary. Well, what about the rest of that? That's good material. You're going to have a chance to see all that. In any case, I did a documentary on outfitting the kitchen. What goes into a kitchen? And it's fun. Like, I do something that makes dishes really sparkle. And those of you who've been to the retreats, we bring in 2 outstanding chefs and gourmet chefs. And then other chefs volunteer because they want to be in the kitchen. So sometimes we have 6 chefs from around the United States in the kitchen making these wonderful dishes. And right now I'm working on creating 80 new recipes. And we're testing them at night and photographing them. They're going to be in a new book, but that's not for about 7 months from now. But that's what my next retreat, people are going to eat them. But then how do I make simple dishes taste so different? Here's the key. Here's the trick. Try this. Get little bottles and fill the bottles up with what's your own made tincture. Let's say I want tangerine and kiwi. So I'll take a kiwi and I'll juice it. I'll take a lime and juice it. I then mix the two together with some olive oil, and that becomes the flavoring that I'll put. And I would squirt tangerine and kiwi on kale, because kale's boring. It's very nutritious, but it's boring. This way it's tasty. It's delicious. And then I might take a mint, fresh mint, and I would soak them in overnight. And then I would take the mint water and pour that into a little bottle and I would put in there, I would put rosemary mint. And then when I'm making, let's say, some tempeh, I would bake the tempeh after I've soaked it overnight in that mint rosemary water. And suddenly these wonderful flavors start to envelop your tongue. And you think, wow, I'm used to eating plain tempeh, and this is tasty. So it's these infusions where you infuse the food with the essence of an orange or cherry raspberry. I'll take cherry raspberry infusion. I'll juice. Sometimes I don't even juice. I'll use a blender. I'll blend down the raspberry, pine of cherries, and then I might add in coconut, real coconut meat, and a little coconut milk. Now I have an infusion. And let's say I'm making a dish that I want to kind of excite someone. I'll make a watercress and arugula salad. I'll put in a cup of pomegranate seeds, little berries, and then I'll infuse it, spray it over the top. And by spraying it, you can either squeeze it on or spray it. I like spraying it. Now they get all that wonderful flavors. They're eating a salad that have very distinct flavor, like arugula is very distinct, watercress very distinct. But now they've got those little orbs that are bursting in their mouth, which is giving it a different flavor. And also, there's a different taste, the cherry, the strawberry, raspberry. So I might have, when I used to have my restaurant, in fact, how many, right now, were any of you ever in the Fertile Earth at 108th and Broadway? The first gourmet vegan restaurant in American history? Anyone? Call us at 888-874-4888. That was 1970. That's a long time ago. And it was so much fun. I did it as a cooperative. I didn't do it as a business. I wanted people, no matter what their background, rich or poor, to be able to have a gourmet vegan meal for $2.25. That was cheap even then. And it turned out to be the meeting place for so many of the social activists. The Berrigan brothers would eat there. And it's like every night from 4 o'clock to 11, it was packed with people engaged in political activist activities. But they always had these great meals. And simple selection, two meals, that's it. Two entrees, two soups, two salads, two desserts. But I changed it every day. But if you look back in the kitchen or Gary's place over on Columbus, it was a lot of fun. There'd be like 40 different seasonings and 40 different infusions. And that way I could, with just few items, make everything taste differently. I want you to try this. Just try these ideas. For example, try doing this. Try taking a baked potato and putting some, sauteing some shiitake mushrooms with shallots and garlic, and saute the garlic only till it's translucent. Never high heat garlic because it's burnt and it's acrid. And then put the shiitake mushrooms and the garlic in the potato, and then spritz lemon juice on it. No salt, but then pepper. Lemon juice will change completely the mouthfeel of the potato. Just something simple. Anyhow, I'm going to find all my footage of how to stock the kitchen, utensils, how to use different things, how to make different dishes, and I'll do that in the month of October. Okay? Just things that are coming. Now, this is from Natural Blaze. And by the way, I recommend people read the Natural Blaze. They're good people. They do good work. And they're very progressive. This is what they're saying. This is from Kathleen Frompovich, who's a good reporter. The United States Health and Human Services, that's the body that oversees the National Cancer Institute, the National Institutes of Mental Health, National Institutes of Allergy and Infectious Disease, FDA, the CDC, it under its control are all of our health agencies. Health and Human Services, quote, never performed any vaccine safety testing as required by law in Congress in over 32 years. Wow. Listen again. For all you pro-vaccine people, you're advocating vaccines, and I understand why, and I appreciate it. You want people to be protected. You don't want someone who's not vaccinated, you believe, to impact the herd by bringing their disease into a herd of people who have been vaccinated and then cause them to be sick. Of course, the reverse engineer your logic, someone who has been vaccinated should be protected. It is the person who is not vaccinated who should be concerned. So your logic is wrong, and the science doesn't support herd mentality to begin with. But now you're suggesting people get their vaccines because it's safe, and here is Health and Human Services acknowledging that, quote, Health and Human Services never perform any vaccine safety testing as required by law and Congress in over 32 years. Big Pharma vaccine testing lasts only for 4 to 5 days, not years, days. Let me repeat that. Big Pharma vaccine testing lasts only 4 to 5 days. Thanks to the remarkable legal work done by Robert Kennedy Jr., who we've had on this program, and Del Bigtree, we finally have proof through the Freedom of Information Act documents that Health and Human Services has defaulted big time regarding safety vaccines. Health and Human Services never has given Congress the safety testing records the law and Congress required because Health and Human Services never performed them in 32 years. In the 1986 vaccine law mandating Health and Human Services to perform safety studies every 2 years and render the results to Congress, that unconscionable default by Health and Human Services, the CDC, and the FDA should be the very reason for rescinding the 1986 vaccine law. Furthermore, informed consent regarding vaccines and vaccines safety should be mandatory for those who want vaccines, and it's not. So, and to one of the people listening, I think right now, who sent me a question. Around the world, other countries are waking up, mainly due to citizen activists. They are challenging the safety data. In Japan, for example, vaccines generally start at age of 2. Why? Because they were concerned about the incidence of sudden infant death syndrome. Because of postponing until the baby was 2 years old and began to develop an immune system, the incidence, statistical incidence of sudden infant death syndrome, babies just dying, what we call crib death, had plummeted. This is also true in other countries. Now, I've written 51 articles, all fully supported by documentation. They are vetted by scholars and research and our legal staff, because you have no idea how many groups and activist groups have used information produced over the years, from stopping fluoridation, using the fluoride fiasco as citizens' action. We did all the research, have all the studies showing what's wrong with fluoride, and it doesn't protect your teeth and it's dangerous to vaccines. So we have a very high bar that we have to reach in accuracy and proof. I cannot find a single study in the world literature that shows that a country's population is healthier and protected, especially its children, from the vaccine schedule we give in the United States. So other countries are now fighting back. In Ireland, they're fighting back because the high incidence of destruction to young girls' immune systems and now young boys, and they're dying. And so they've gotten legislators to bring testimony in public hearings. Against that, the vaccine industry is pushing hard. Here's where we need to go with this. First, educate yourself. Please go to PRN.FM or Progressive Radio Network. We have all the articles there. Download the articles. Read them. I have 5 documentaries, the latest being the A Deadly Deception. Watch it. And then let us start to make an effort to have congressional hearings to reverse this mandate that allowed all vaccine manufacturers to be exempt from any liability. You cannot sue a vaccine manufacturer. I'll put it another way. Here's how draconian it is. If every single person taking vaccines were to have adverse effects, you couldn't sue any manufacturer. We need that law reversed. We need it. We need them responsible. If you take if you get adverse effects from any other drug, any other treatment, you can sue. You should be able to do the same for vaccines. Then watch how quickly they stop giving mandatory vaccines. Then watch how few vaccines are offered, because it's just a game. It's just for profit, and they're exploiting it. Now, we're going to take a break, and when we come back from the break, we're 31 minutes into our program. We're going to go directly into 2 short segments, both dealing with the government stepping over all boundaries of citizen rights, parents' rights, to dictate what is proper treatment for a child. And they're wrong on both. Then after that, I want you to call in with your responses and on this, of how the government is impinging and then mandating that we have vaccines and telling us that mercury in our teeth is not toxic when all the toxicological evidence shows that it is, and that there's only one way we can treat cancer, according to the state medical boards and the medical and scientific community. It's got to be by current scientific methods, and yet we can show that 50% of cancers are due to the chemotherapy and radiation, and the chemotherapy is not working. We've lost the war on cancer, yet they're mandating. So once you step into their realm, into a hospital, into a clinic, into a school, the nanny state takes over. And this is a dangerous road that we're following. Back in a moment.
Of the doctors who had treated her
knew
her medical history.
They weren't allowed to come in.
So now jump to Thursday. I get there around noontime, and I go right to the nurse's station. I said, I'm Lou Pelletier, Justina Pelletier's dad. I'm here to discharge her, to actually take her across town to Tufts. So she has an appointment. And they kind of, they're fumbling their papers, and we have to get the attending physician involved. And they just kept dragging. And then we get brought into a room, and they say, we've reported you to Child Protective Services with the DCF, with the state of Massachusetts, that you're not following our medical protocol, so we're taking your child. I said, what?
Do you imagine getting a piece of paper that says you're not allowed to talk to your prior doctors, even the doctor who's at Boston Children's now?
They banned you from talking to your daughter's own medical provider.
Yes. And they took over and just erased everything.
They took their second opinion as the only opinion. And so they thought they were God, and they scooted us out. We got escorted out of the building, which, talk about, never mind embarrassing. We're also crushed because they just kidnapped our daughter. And that's what I told the state, the Mass police.
This was a medical kidnapping.
This was medical, pure and simply medical kidnapping.
It almost was like you were literally ripped away.
And I couldn't say goodbye to my daughter because the security guards were blocking me.
Meanwhile, their youngest daughter was kept in the dark, waiting for her parents and waiting to go home. She sits down with her oldest sister to talk about the ordeal.
Like, when I first got there, I just thought it was a miscommunication. It just didn't make any sense. So I'm like, come on, let's, you know, get things moving. And then as soon as, like, weeks later, I realized something was wrong.
While Justina was inside Boston Children's Hospital, her parents were on the outside fighting to keep their child.
We have to appear in court tomorrow morning at 9 a.m. We're from Connecticut.
And you've got three other daughters and your mother.
I don't know any lawyers.
And we have to get a lawyer.
To represent us at 9 o'clock in the morning, and here we're at what, 6, 7 at night?
Oh, yeah, it's already nighttime. We got to find a lawyer to show up the next morning with us. The system is just really peachy there in Massachusetts. And so we found somebody, a friend of a friend, you know, it really wasn't his area, but at least we got somebody to come in to have some legal representation. We go to this court, and it was a kangaroo court. Because they came in, the first thing they threw out there, that it was Munchausen by proxy. Parents are doing something to
their kids. Or causing their kids to be ill.
Court was on the 15th. She arrived at the 10th. So they've been in control of her for already 5 days. So if we were Munchausen by proxy our children, our child, there already would have been signs that would have been fading away.
But the Pelletiers insist their daughter was getting worse.
Did you at any time ever mistreat your daughter or endanger her welfare?
No.
No.
Not even close.
Where did this come from?
I don't know. If you can find out, I'd love to know. I would, because I am so hurt and upset. And more, when I was going through it,
yeah,
I had to keep myself together.
Yeah.
Because you have to stay strong. But now it's not as easy.
This is what I think is so shocking and chilling for any parent. In America, that they could bring their child in to be treated for the flu and then have that child stripped from them and be under suspicion by child welfare, by elite doctors at these wealthy institutions. You are up against the world.
A social worker noted doctors stated the parents are obstructing child's care. The affidavit also says, child is not safe to be discharged. It concludes that this child is at risk for medical neglect by her parents and requests custody of the child. And that's how the nearly 18-month battle over Justina Pelletier began.
Okay, this is just one small example. Let me add something on to this. One day, I'm sitting at my desk, and I have a large stack of emails and letters from people that have been printed out, and I'm looking. There's a little small one. It's not even a regular piece of paper, and it was handwritten, and it says, "Can you help me? I'm in prison in Florida. I'm here for life. I'm accused of shaking my baby to death. I did not do that. The vaccines did it." And I left it there, and I'd look about it every couple of days, and finally I just said, what the heck? I'm going to take some time. And I began to look into this. And I interviewed him. And I believed him. And I interviewed his wife. And I know a lot of parents have had charges brought against them that they shook their baby, which caused brain damage when it was the vaccines. So I got on the case, and we got him a lawyer, and then we began to do the deep research. And finally we got him a new hearing because there was so much wrong in his autopsy report of the kid, the state. They even had the state, he's Caucasian, they had his child as African American. What was the wrong baby? They were doing an autopsy on them. Everything was wrong about it, but he was a poor working class person. He couldn't hire attorneys, and so they convicted him. But once we got the records and once we started seeing all that was wrong with it, he was granted a new trial. And then we brought in from around the country, even from Australia, Dr. Kelly Kokorius, experts. So I went down there. And Manette Loudon at that time, she just recently passed, but Manette was the frontline producer, and we set up, and no one else was in the court. And our experts presented the case and virtually destroyed the state's case, destroyed it. The prosecutor, everyone abdicated, and they said, he's innocent. They let him go that day. And then suddenly Fox News and NBC and ABC, everybody started calling and say they rushed over, but it's too late. We had filmed everything, and we let him use our film footage. His name was Alan Yurko. And if you watch Autism Made in USA, if you watch Vaccine Nation, you'll see him. And the lesson is that there are thousands of parents who've been accused of different things involving their children who are innocent, and they generally don't have the resources. This family's fighting over 18 months, spending their life savings because they did not see their daughter getting better at traditional medical therapy, and they wanted to try some other therapies. Also traditional, a Tufts University. They were willing to have another doctor, board-certified physician, at another medical center treat, and this center said no. Now let's go over and say hello to Professor Michael Hudson. He's one of our nation's finest and most respected economists. He is also the author of many different books, including Killing the Host, How Financial Parasites and Debt Bondage Destroy the Global Economy. And his website is michael-hudson.com. Nice to have you with us today, Michael.
It's good to be back here. Thanks for having me, Gary.
I'm only going to give you one question. How about that?
Okay.
Here's the question. Donald Trump and his economic team have decided that tariffs are a good idea to protect American jobs, to protect American products so they can be offered into the marketplace so they're not competing against foreign goods, including China, that frequently resent tariffs on products and therefore have adversely affected us. We're told that by putting in these sanctions against other countries importing their goods to be sold, that that's good for America, saves jobs. You're the person who can tell us what will ultimately be the outcome, not just short-term outcome, but the long-term outcome of these different types of tariffs in this trade war that Donald Trump has ignited with his Council of Economic Advisors. The forum is yours.
Well, for countries that have not really developed their own industry, like America in the 19th century, tariff protection was great. It did raise prices for a while, but it enabled producers to be able to invest in factories and means of production and become independent. In a way, what Trump is doing by sanctions is the equivalent of letting Russia, China, and other countries have their own trade protection. Under the World Trade Organization that America pushed after World War II, countries aren't allowed to protect their industry or agriculture. And the whole aim of the World Trade Organization was to make other countries dependent on the U.S., U.S. food especially, and key U.S. products. And that means that enabled the United States to make the following threat to other countries. If you do a policy we don't like, if you don't have a tax system that we like, if you don't sell your oil and raw materials to us, we can stop exporting to you, and we can starve you, or we can wreck your banking system by having you isolated financially like the United States is doing to Iran and Russia today. So the irony is that by putting sanctions on Russia, this has been the greatest benefit that Russia and Putin could possibly have had. The first effect was in agriculture. The Baltic countries were not allowed to sell their cheese and their farm products to Russia, and so Russian farm products developed their own dairy industry. They're now producing their own cheese. Their agriculture has grown more rapidly than any other sector. So America has enabled Russia to build up its agriculture and to become independent of the United States. And when America said, well, we can stop exporting key goods to China and we can put a chokehold on them, China said, this means that we cannot depend on American goods at all. This means that we have to develop our high technology industry and our agriculture completely independently of the United States. And Europe is doing the same thing. When Donald Trump went to England, where I was last week, and told the Prime Minister, well, if you keep your trade open with the common market, with the European community, you're going and you obey their trade rules, that means no genetically modified food from the United States. That means no chlorinated chicken. You're not going to be able to trade with the United States. So he's driven England into a common bond with the rest of Europe. Trump has really done what every peace-loving liberal would love. He's united the whole world, but he's united the whole world to become self-sufficient against the United States, and that may or may not be an intended consequence. I don't think he understands the consequence, but the Russia haters and the national security agencies are so enamored with free trade theory and with neoliberalism and with right-wing economics that they don't realize that what they're doing, thinking that they're going to punish Russia and China and Europe, is actually making them independent, developing their own agriculture, developing their own industry, and driving the whole world together into a common mutual interdependency because they can't depend on the United States anymore.
I appreciate that answer. And also from my own research, I have found that Putin is smart enough to capitalize on the anti-GMO movement and has banned all GMO products from being grown or sold in Russia, and is now claiming that Russia will be the largest producer of organically grown certified produce in the world. And that means that the average person, especially in other countries, they want organically grown food. Americans are increasing their desire and their request for organically grown, non-GMOs. And so here Trump didn't pay attention. Also, when you look at self-sufficiency, if I knew that I had to do things on my own, I couldn't rely upon someone else to do them for me, that strengthens me. And I remember when I was growing up, and I'm sure it was the same for you, Michael, in every household there was someone who could do plumbing, masonry, carpentry, fix a car engine, right? We were self-sufficient, and that's because our parents had grown up during the Great Depression, and they had to know how to be self-sufficient. Today, everything is outsourced to service areas and people, and so the United States has become a service nation and a consuming nation, not a manufacturing nation, and certainly not self-sufficient as we once were. Where other countries that we put these sanctions on, it's worked to their benefit. Now, one of the things that you better stop and think about if you're in the satellite business, cell phone business, computer business, camera business, all of those require different types of exotic and rare minerals. And guess who controls more minerals than all the other countries in the world combined, these precious minerals? China. So you really play hardball with China. Understand that China thinks long term, not short term. They're not emotionally reactive to situations. And I wouldn't want to be in a trade war with people who are manufacturing and holding materials that industries in the United States need in order to function. And that's going to be, could be one of the unintended consequences of Trump's foolish policies of thinking that somehow he's going to show the world that he's tough on these countries without looking carefully at what these countries have that other industries in the United States may need. Final thoughts?
Well, I wish you were right about China. I don't think they're thinking about rare earth elements quite that way. I spent a week with the Central Committee a few years ago talking about rare earths, and I was urging them to raise the price even then. They finally did raise the price by 10 times. Most of the rare earths in China are produced and leased to a Taiwanese consortium of companies, and the Chinese were only letting them export them at the cost of labor. They weren't looking at the other costs. Certainly the United States could produce rare earths from the molybdenum corporation. The rare earths are found with molybdenum. They're all over the world. So that's really not the key so much as the computer inputs and the other essential things that China makes, like wheelbases. It can pull its particular exports that are needed to make cars, to make other things, to make computers and screens, and sort of disrupt America's supply chain, just as America can disrupt China's supply chain. And the whole world has learned in the last year that America intends to use this lever to destroy other countries' supply chain if they don't pursue American military policies in the Near East and Africa and elsewhere. And so all of a sudden, other countries are becoming independent of the supply chains. Afghanistan has a lot of rare earths, by the way. North Korea, mountainous areas, have a lot of rare earths. They're usually found where they're large mountain areas. So the problem that I convinced China to do was when you mine rare earths, it's a very dirty, polluting activity, and I asked them to add the charge, the cleanup charges, to the export prices. When Trump put the 25% tariffs on Chinese manufacturers, I suggested to China when I was in Beijing a few weeks ago that they impose a 25% export charge. Why should American government get all of the tariff revenues from China selling its goods so cheaply? Why shouldn't China get these as well? And that would raise the price, that would double the price of most Walmart goods imported from China. The effect of what Trump is doing is going to be to very sharply increase the cost of consumer goods to America, to increase the cost of doing business, and by putting tariffs on raw materials such as steel and aluminum, he's made it unprofitable for American manufacturers to make manufactured goods and much cheaper to import these manufactured goods from countries that America has not declared economic war, such as Europe and Canada and Latin America. So Trump's policies are literally shooting America in the foot and giving the cost advantage to foreign countries instead of this country. That's really the result of the economic ideology that Trump's right-wing supporters are feeding him.
I appreciate that, Michael. Thank you for those insights. Also, I did some research to find out that China has very quietly been going around the world for the last 20 years, giving very large contracts to countries where they have some natural minerals that they needed, since China does not have all these themselves.
Right.
And they purchased huge amounts. In fact, sometimes they're the exclusive purchaser of a country's raw materials for their own needs. And so, again, we should pay attention. Not always the best approach just to be a braggadocio person and try to get credit for something that's really a foolish policy. And thank you for your guidance on this, and we look forward to our next discussion.
It's always good to be here, Gary.
Thank you. Professor Michael Hudson. Tomorrow I'm going to talk about how a court ruled that a school can continue using electric shock as punishment for special needs students. Seems dystopian, seems impossible, actually happening now as we speak, and the court sided with the school. We'll be providing you with information why all electroconvulsive therapy, all electric shock is dangerous. All of it destroys brain cells. All of it is a harm to the brain. And a lot of other things we're going to share as well. And tomorrow we're going to put up a on the screen the newest recipes that I just made this week. They're my gift to you. There will be the photograph of how they should look when you're making them, and then the recipe of how to make them. Have a nice day, everyone.
When the night has come and the land is dark and the moon is the only light we'll see.